Hello and welcome to EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. I'm your host, Abigail Galvan.
The gold standard. A new report says the Olympics might have a major change when it comes to women's sports. We have analysis from Julie Gunlock.
What I've started to say, a bit provocatively, in particular to the older audiences to whom I speak, is don't join the statistic. This is not a way to honor the exceptional life you've lived.
Concern in Canada amid the country's push to expand euthanasia. One pro-lifer spreads a message of hope. And baby bump. Meet the college student who is driven to fight for the unborn.
A new report says the International Olympic Committee is set to ban biological men from competing in women's events. The New York Times says the change will be officially announced early next year. The decision to overhaul the current policy was made after a committee carried out a science-based review of biologically born men and their physical differences from women. Sources told the New York Times the evidence was scientific, factual, and unemotional. It is not clear if the guidance will be ready for the Winter Games in 2026 in Italy. The next Summer Olympics is in Los Angeles in 2028. The Supreme Court allows the Trump administration to require passports to list the applicant's biological sex. The order is seen as a victory in efforts to roll back transgender ideology and federal policy. The nation's highest court says requiring biological sex on a passport is roughly the same as displaying the applicant's country of birth, adding the government is merely attesting to a historical fact without subjecting anyone to differential treatment. The decision overturns a lower court order. The lawsuit was brought by a woman who identifies as a man. For more, we turn to Julie Gunlock, director of the Independent Women's Forum, Center for Progress and Innovation. Julie, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, there's a lot to discuss, including the Supreme Court order on passports and biological sex. But first, can we turn to the report on the Olympics likely barring biological men from women's events? What do you make of this report and its timing?
This is great news, and it's been a long time coming. This is a science-based policy that affirms biological reality. It restores fairness to women's athletics on the international stage. Now, I will tell you, there's an awful lot of women out there who've been asking for this for years. The fact that the Olympics finally recognized what should have been obvious all along, there is some frustration, I think, among some athletes. Look, these women, they have lost medals, they've lost scholarships, they've lost a living. And some of them were actually hurt having to compete against men. So while this is good news, there are an awful lot of women who are going, what took so long?
Now, remind us again about the Olympics policy towards transgender athletes. It seems like some events allowed biological men and others did not, at least in qualifying.
Yeah, they had it depended on how long you had been on cross-sex hormones. They would test people. But the scientific studies show that the men who've gone through puberty, they have strengths post-puberty that can't be reversed. So we're talking about the capacity in their lungs, the largeness of their hearts, the ability to throw things faster and longer, a longer distance, that doesn't go away. You can take a cross-sex hormone, but it doesn't take away the fact that you have that strength that's sort of built in. So now they're just saying, look, we are not going to go through all this trickery. We're not going to try to make sense of this. We're going back to common sense. Women compete against women. Men compete against men. That is the way forward.
Now, let's turn to the Supreme Court order on the listings of biological birth on a passport. What can you tell us about it?
Well, this was a case of the Supreme Court blocking a temporary hold that was put on by a activist federal judge in, no surprise, Massachusetts, that would have required the State Department to issue passports to transgender identifying Americans that reflected their sex designation. So whatever they chose on their passport, that obviously makes no sense. And now the Supreme Court is saying, okay, displaying a passport holder's sex at birth is no more offensive than displaying their country of birth. I mean, frankly, I would love to be. I'd love to say that I, you know, I'm Italian or I'm French. But this is a security issue. This is what everyone forgets. You know, we're not so far away from 9/11, and passports are a security document. And so the idea that we're just going to put on there a sex that does not correspond to the biological reality was nonsense. So I am very grateful to the Supreme Court for setting this activist judge correctly and really returning things back to normal.
And as we mentioned, it was an unsigned order. What does that mean? And is it relevant?
Well, it's an unsigned order, meaning that the court did not, the opinion wasn't signed by one of the judges. So we're not sure who authored this particular ruling. And I'm, to be honest with you, I'm not sure why.
Well, Julie, thank you so much for being with us and sharing this perspective.
Thanks for having me.
A new report says Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America is set to spend $80 million in the midterm elections in 2026. A story in Politico says the pro-life group is targeting at least four battleground states. We will have much more on this story next week. Florida is suing Planned Parenthood for $350 million for saying abortion pills are safer than Tylenol. Evidence shows a high rate of hospitalization for women who take the drug mifepristone to induce abortions. Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer sat down with EWTN News In-Depth's Catherine Hadro and told her the abortion giant has been wrongfully deceiving women about the abortion pill.
One in 25 women that take these chemical pills end up in the hospital, and we've seen dozens of deaths resulting. We want to hold people accountable for hurting our women, for hurting our children, and these lawsuits are seeking to do it.
If you would like to watch the full interview with Attorney General Uthmeyer, you can find it on our new EWTN News YouTube page. Pope Leo says his prayer intention for the month of November is for the prevention of suicide.
Give all of us an attentive and compassionate heart, capable of offering comfort and support.
The Holy Father asks the faithful to pray that those with suicidal thoughts might find the support, care, and love they need in their community and be open to the beauty of life, adding that together we can discover life is a gift and there is beauty and meaning even in the midst of pain. A pro-life campaigner in Canada is raising awareness to the dangers of assisted suicide. Amanda Achtman launched Dying to Meet You to reshape the conversation around death and people's inherent worth. She also says we do not have a culture of death, but death without culture.
I thought, how can we learn from the richness and breadth of cultural traditions to restore the meaning of death and dying?
The pro-life leader says she wants to humanize the conversation about suffering, death, meaning, and hope, adding her goal is to lead others to realize every human person has value. And Amanda Achtman from Dying to Meet You, a pro-life leader in Canada, joins us now. Amanda, great to be with you. As we mentioned, you say it is not so much a culture of death, but death without culture. What do you mean by that?
I mean that we're losing the cultural tenor around death and dying. We're losing the rituals and the mores, the customs and traditions that pertain to suffering, dying, grieving, and hoping. And that cultural crisis is what has led to our euthanasia crisis here in Canada.
And Amanda, can you tell us more about Dying to Meet You? What are the reactions of people, especially young people, to your work?
I created Dying to Meet You, first of all, as a project of my own catharsis. I was working in the office of a member of parliament a few years ago, trying to prevent the legislative expansion of euthanasia on the basis of disability and mental illness. It was very challenging to be a Christian pro-life political staffer, knowing that this law expanding euthanasia was a foregone conclusion and going to pass anyway. And that inspired me to think, what can I do personally to contribute toward a culture of life in Canada? So I started blogging and having casual conversations every day with Canadians about these topics of end of life and trying to find a humanizing angle that would be edifying and orienting. And since then, I discerned the need to take this project to the next level. So now through writing, speaking, producing short films, and cooperating with different dioceses across Canada, I call them diocesan activation weeks, where a bishop will invite me and I'll give formation and facilitate intergenerational activities across Canada, and increasingly be invited to speak around the world. There's such a need and a hunger to engage these topics, because really not a day goes by that I do not hear about how euthanasia is affecting people personally. And for my generation, I'm a millennial, one of the chief ways that euthanasia is affecting my friends is because they're losing their grandparents to euthanasia. We also know that tens of thousands of Canadians have died by euthanasia, but very few family members speak out. And as I'm seeing in accompanying people who share their story, I'm starting to see why. The reason is because family members are met with the, it's not about you, just get over it. Mm-hmm. And that is a compounding sorrow, a compounding wound that is so difficult. But I am really determined to come alongside the family members who have been affected and to share to those who might be tempted to euthanasia that this is not a victimless choice. It affects, as Benjamin says in his video, multiple generations.
Amanda, that's really beautiful, and I really applaud you for doing this work. You mentioned you've been working in this movement for a long time and felt the need to start bringing these stories. Since you've started this project, have you seen a lot of change in the people you engage with on this topic?
Many people tell me that they've never thought that deeply about it before, especially many people don't expect euthanasia to touch them until it does. A lot of times people think that euthanasia is restricted for the most marginal of cases. But what I've started to say a bit provocatively, in particular to the older audiences to whom I speak, is don't join the statistic. This is not a way to honor the exceptional life you've lived, because you don't become part of an exceptional cohort in death, but rather a statistic that has contributed to making Canada the euthanasia capital of the world. What we're seeing in Canada is the direct, deliberate ending of life within 15 minutes, reducing a person's death to an appointment that conveniently suits the lives of others. And when people express the desire for it, I do not believe they are so much expressing the desire to die as they are betraying a real disappointment in their heart.
Now, Amanda, you have an interesting faith background with a lot of intersection of Catholic and Jewish traditions. How does your faith play a role in your work?
Well, one of the guiding motivations for my work was the close experience that I had with my grandfather. He was a Polish Jew who thankfully came to Canada just before the Second World War. And I learned growing up that all of the extended family, all of the people with my last name in Europe, perished in the Holocaust. And this really heightened my sensitivity to the value of life and to the precariousness that happens whenever life is at risk of being discarded, dismissed, or discounted. And so euthanasia really represents a crisis of self-harm and self-esteem, but because it predominantly concerns the elderly, we don't always think about it that way. But Pope Francis was always saying that the alliance between old and young will save the human family. And I really felt in the years that I was following Pope Francis's remarks on the meaning and value of aging in scripture, I like to think of it as a theology of aging, that it really encapsulated the precious gift that I had of having my grandfather in my life.
Amanda, if our viewers would like more information, where can they go?
Check out dyingtomeetyou.com. You can see the short films I've released, lots of podcasts, articles, and get in touch with me if you'd like to.
Amanda, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. God bless.
Italy is one of the countries in the European Union that allows assisted suicide under certain conditions. Much like in Canada, there is an effort, especially among young people, to push back. EWTN Vatican journalist Zofia Zubak has more.
Don't kill me. This was the message that echoed throughout Piazza del Popolo in Rome as 200 empty wheelchairs stood in symbol to protest attacks on society's most vulnerable.
If an able-bodied person wants to jump off a bridge, everyone rushes to help them, to rescue them. But if it's a disabled person or a terminally ill patient who asks for it, the state offers them the syringe and the path to death.
Assisted suicide and euthanasia laws have been creeping into the Italian system since 2019.
This flash mob today is organized to emphasize an important point. The state should alleviate the suffering of the sick, not allow them to be put to death.
The constitutional courts ruled that assisted suicide is not always a crime. It is permitted if the individual is dealing with, quote, unbearable suffering and able to make a clear, conscious and informed decision. After the court ruling in 2019, some ethics committees and courts authorized assisted suicide on an individual basis, but without a consistent national or regional procedure. In 2025, Tuscany and Sardinia became the first regions in Italy to formally approve laws that regulate assisted suicide in line with the constitutional court.
We know that wherever a law on assisted suicide and euthanasia has been passed, the boundaries have gradually widened. It opens the door to many people. That is, euthanasia could end up being used simply because someone is depressed, simply because someone has lost their job.
Several countries around the world have legalized assisted suicide, including Canada, the Netherlands, and Switzerland. A handful of states in the United States also have legalized assisted suicide. Now, there are fears those rulings will have massive consequences on society. Tony Brandi, president of Italy's organization Pro Vita Familia, explains the issues with ending a life, even when the person consents.
Simply because when you're sick, without cure, without any assistance, you are depressed and you start being afraid of living more than being afraid of dying.
Advocates say that the legalization of assisted suicide is an abandonment of the value of life. By strengthening palliative care, the country can offer dignity to every member of its society.
This government, a center-right government, cannot pass this law. These laws are fake, progressive laws of the left. One must know how to say no, hold your head high, and focus on the real needs of the country, which are not a law on end-of-life issues.
In Rome, Zofia Tubak for EWTN Pro-Life Weekly.
Assisted suicide, euthanasia, and palliative care. We hear these terms more and more. Lawmakers in Illinois and Uruguay recently advanced measures related to euthanasia. And as we just heard, many countries have legalized some form of assisted suicide. But what are the differences between euthanasia, assisted suicide, and palliative care? And what does the church teach about these practices?
When it comes right down to it, is murder.
Euthanasia is the act of deliberately ending a person's life by a medical professional. Supporters say it is a way to relieve someone of their pain and suffering. They add patients are often living with a serious or terminal illness and are in the final stages of their lives. While this might sound merciful, it isn't. We see cases where people are not terminally ill or where there is a form of coercion. The church strongly opposes this practice in all forms. Euthanasia can be broken down into three categories: voluntary euthanasia, when the patient requests to die, involuntary euthanasia, when a person is murdered against his or her wishes, and non-voluntary euthanasia, when the person is not capable of giving consent.
you typically would consent in the beginning of the euthanasia process. But once your consent is given, there's a more possibility of you changing your mind. I don't know any other medical treatment or quote-unquote medical treatment where this is done. There's been multiple examples where patients who at one point consented to euthanasia decide that they no longer want to be euthanized. But if you've already given up your rights, then you're essentially forced into it.
Assisted suicide, sometimes referred to as physician-assisted suicide, is when a doctor or medical professional provides a patient with drugs to end his or her life. The Catholic Church condemns both assisted suicide and euthanasia. According to the Catechism, any action or lack of action that intentionally, quote, causes death in order to eliminate suffering constitutes a murder gravely contrary to the dignity of the human person and to the respect due to the living God, his creator, unquote. The Church teaches that bodily death, from which man would have been immune if he had not sinned, is the last enemy of man to be conquered. To rise with Christ, we must die with Christ. That means grappling with and accepting our natural death. But we don't have to do this alone. The Church supports and endorses palliative care. Palliative care is focused on providing relief from the symptoms and stress of serious illness. The goal is to improve the quality of life for both the patient and the family.
In palliative care, we are recognizing the dignity of the person and the worth of the person, and we are applying our best efforts to try to relieve suffering and help that person to experience their life as meaningful, you know, to the greatest degree possible.
Sister Constance Veit has been with the Little Sisters of the Poor for more than 30 years. An important part of her order's mission is to care for the elderly who are sick and also need financial assistance. She says her and her sisters are not experts on dying or palliative care through study, rather through practical life experience, something she says the faithful can do too.
I think you don't have to be a professional caregiver to learn a few skills to be able to be a meaningful and caring presence around the dying or the chronically ill. You know, it's not rocket science. It's human warmth and decency and caring. And if there were more people available to provide that, to support family caregivers or to, you know, to come into homes and spend time with people to relieve the burden on family caregivers or just to spend time with someone who's in a very vulnerable position, I think there would be less temptation to want to end one's life.
Coming up, a sticky situation. We introduce you to a 22-year-old student and the unique way he fights for the unborn. You're watching EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. I'm Abigail Galvan. Welcome back to our program. We have reached the final State March for Life of 2025. This week, we bring you to Lansing, Michigan. The event drew thousands of pro-life marchers from across the Mitten State. The day began with a concert at the state capitol, then a rally with pro-life speakers, including Bishop Earl Boyea from the Diocese of Lansing, plus Mayra Rodriguez, a Planned Parenthood whistleblower, and several others. The rally was followed by a march around the city of Lansing. Next up is the National March for Life on January 23, 2026, in Washington, D.C. Finally, tonight, a 22-year-old college student in Massachusetts came up with a creative way to fight for the unborn, and you could almost say he is sticking with it. Gabriel Dionisi provides free pro-life bumper stickers for cars. He began the initiative in 2018 and estimates in that time he has given out 10,000 stickers in 45 of the 50 U.S. states. The stickers include a referral to a website run by Heartbeat International and a map of pregnancy resource centers across the country. And Gabriel Dionisi, a college student who gives out free pro-life bumper stickers, joins us now. Gabriel, thanks for being with us. Tell us about these stickers and why you chose this as a way to fight for the unborn.
Hey, thank you, Abigail. So happy to be here. While I make these pro-life bumper stickers, you can see the design right here. They say choose life and then pregnant need help optionline.org. So the reason I make these bumper stickers is to save babies from abortion, because so many women who are at risk of abortion, they don't really want to have an abortion in many cases, but they feel pressured or like they have no choices. And we know that the pro-life movement offers a lot in terms of material, spiritual, community support to these women to help them choose life and build a great life for them and their baby. But not enough women know about it. And I just think if we raise that awareness, a lot of women will be able to find help and choose life for their babies.
That's a brilliant idea. So how do you distribute these bumper stickers?
Yeah, well, I have a website called prolifestickers.com, and anyone's welcome to go on there and make a request. I send these out to people for free. There's a quantity limit, but send them for free. And I always love to get these out to churches, Bible studies, pro-life groups, and just, you know, to share with your friends and family. It's such an amazing way to multiply your impact for pro-life, because if you think about it, if that bumper sticker is on your car and 20 people see it every day, you multiply that by 365, and that's over 7,000 views just in a year.
You're so right. That's brilliant. Now, out of curiosity, have you ever gone out and seen one of your bumper stickers being used in that way?
Oh, yeah, I have. At my church and at different pro-life events in Massachusetts, I see them quite a bit.
That's great. Now, we know you were born and raised Catholic. When did you decide to fight for the unborn?
Sure. So when I was a teenager, I started to take my faith a bit more seriously and learn more about it. And as part of that, I was reading Catholic news and starting to become aware of the abortion issue. And I didn't know before how widespread it was, and I didn't know just how horrific the methods are that they use to kill the baby in the womb. And knowing those things disturbed me, and also learning about how many women were feeling pressured and coerced, it also made me feel like there's actually something we could do, even without changing the laws, to still save a lot of babies. So that's kind of what inspired me.
Well, Gabriel, thank you for your mission. It was such a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you so much.
That does it for this edition of EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. Be sure to like and follow us on our social media channels. You can find us at EWTN Pro-Life on X, Facebook, and Instagram. And sign up for our newsletter, The Pro-Life Pulse, EWTN.com/pro-life. Remember, life is a gift. Your life is a gift. God bless.